Well, thank you all for coming. We are launching a Congressional Dialogue series, which really is an opportunity to take some of our leaders in Congress and in a context that lends itself to conversation as much as anything else, and talk about some of the issues of the day. And, of course, one of the hottest that we have in front of us right now is trade politics. Certainly the response publicly to what's going on with trade, with globalization, how we remain engaged in global economy. We're fortunate to have two of the rising stars in Congress, Congressman Gregory Meeks from the 6th District in New York and Congressman Kevin Brady from the 8th District of Texas. Just to be clear about the geography, the 6th District is southeast Queens. It includes JFK International Airport. A lot of service providers, not only at the airport, but also throughout the New York area. Kevin's district is the southeastern part of Texas, a little northeast of Houston, abuts the Louisiana border, kind of covers everything, I would say, from the suburbs of Houston all the way to some terrific virgin forest and hunting country on the Louisiana border. So virtually anything you want to find in Texas, you would find in Kevin's district, to be honest with you.
That's what we claim anyway. So
what's particularly interesting about talking with both Representative Meeks and Representative Brady is they've both been terrific leaders on trade, terrific leaders internationally. Representative Meeks sits on the Committee on Financial Services, certainly relevant from a New York perspective, also on the Committee on Foreign Relations. And again, many of the arguments that we make about trade are as much foreign policy and security as they are trade. Also, most recently, successfully launched the Congressional Services Caucus, which I want to applaud, Representative Meeks. It's really, frankly, as big as services is in our economy, it's an underserved community in the political process, and I think in the trade policy process as a practical matter. Kevin is a member of the Ways and Means Committee, and Congressman has been a stalwart there, not only on trade, but a host of other issues, tax and Social Security, healthcare policy, really a pioneer in a lot of those areas, trying to create new paths going forward. Also a member of the Joint Economic Committee. So that's our lineup. Just to set the framework, we're obviously at a turning point in many respects in terms of trade policy at this point, not just in the United States, but globally. When I think globally, we're looking at a point where Doha is at least on its last legs, if not dead. And I know someone who looked very much like me said it was so dead we should be checking the pockets for loose change at this point rather than trying to pursue it any further, at least along the route that we have. The FTA has foundered. There's an awful lot going on the international front. Free trade agreements, bilateral free trade agreements that often exclude the United States.
Yeah.
Particularly in Asia, where you see the fastest rising incomes in the world. Back home, obviously, we've just seen the lapse of the president's negotiating authority. We have four agreements before Congress, not clear when those will be considered. And almost more powerfully, when you look at the numbers in terms of public support for trade and for globalization, you've seen an erosion of support, an erosion of support significantly among the college-educated, as well as what we had seen before in the base. And it's a very significant change in sort of the reaction, reflecting an anxiety not just about trade, but about globalization generally and about change in American economic life. And so that's kind of the context within which we're meeting. And part of what I think we want to try and accomplish today are two things. One, not only to get a sense of the direction that we're headed, but also how do you draw new constituencies into this conversation so that you are rebuilding something of a consensus? Are there policy changes that have to be undertaken to get us moving in that direction? Are there other things that the business community, other people ought to do to draw new voices into the conversation in Congress? And also, how do we then try and assert that leadership role the United States is traditionally engaged in at the global level? How do we take that consensus, if we can build it, then translate that into something broader? So I don't know if you guys want to open up with just a couple of comments. And then I have a kind of a starter question, which actually isn't trade-related. But if you want to just offer a couple of thoughts, that'd be an enormous help.
Well, I think that you touched on exactly what my concerns and issues are. You know, oftentimes when we enter the debate about trade, we forget and we leave out what's the problem. You know, why is trade hitting such an obstacle? Why is it hitting such a wall? Most of the times it's because individuals in the United States, you know, whether it's because of trade or not, actually, because, you know, sometimes when you talk about the displacement of jobs. People blame it all on trade.
Right.
They don't talk about, you know, that people are really, some have lost their jobs because of efficiency and technology.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't say stop new technological advances because people are losing jobs. But they say because of the advent of the new 24-hour news now, news channels, and people just putting things on the air, that it has to be trade or globalization. And they also talk about and make you think that trade and or globalization is the reason why developing countries are poor.
Mm-hmm.
But yet, when I scratch my head and think about globalization, it really just started, you know, with the information age, and that's just 10, 15 years ago. And if I'm not mistaken, poverty preceded that. Those countries were still poor. So globalization could not be the cause of poverty. In fact, when you look at it, especially in areas like China and Brazil, etc., because of globalization, it is now lifting people out of poverty. And when you look at what we're doing here in the United States also, there's a shifting of jobs, but we're not losing jobs. There's not more individuals that are unemployed. Our unemployment rate is still low. So the emphasis that we've got to, I believe that we've got to begin to change is how do we touch people at home, those that may be temporarily displaced for a small period of time, whether it's for trade or any other reason. You know, clearly trade adjustments assistance isn't working.
Yeah.
And we've got to broaden it, and we've got to, you know, make sure we do it better. Mm-hmm. Because I think that's what then we'll hit at home and help individuals who may be between the age of 45 and 55, who now is out of work temporarily, but they still have their mortgage payments, they still have their child that's trying to go to college, et cetera, yeah. Still got health care issues. So we've got to figure out what we do there to help them, because that, I think, will then begin to shift the feeling of individuals within this country. Absent to do that, we can go back to this protectionist type of mentality that we had that back with President, I guess it was Harding, et cetera, and we lost more jobs, and we ended up, our economy started to go under, and that's what created the Great Depression.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got to make sure, look at history, let's not repeat the failures of the past, understand what took place when FDR came in and began to talk about opening markets and trading with other individuals and how that got us out of the Depression and started moving us to the greatest boom and to the point where we are today.
I really appreciate that. I remember when I was working on the Finance Committee for Chairman Roth, he always used to stop me before we went either into committee or for a vote or onto the floor, because the lore on the Finance Committee was that Reed Smoot, the senator from Utah, took the bill into the committee and got rolled, basically. and then got rolled again on the floor. So he started out with something that wanted to lift tariffs a little bit, and he ended up with 65% tariffs across the board. So Bill Roth would always stop me on the way in, and he'd grab me one last time, just remind me what if I'd counted the noses, by saying, I'm not going to end up like poor old Reed Smoot, am I? And it was a good lesson, because I do worry now we're in a context where there's enough uncertainty in some respects, Kevin, that you do worry about taking a measure to the floor. You do end up without thinking it through, as you were suggesting. I don't know if you have any thoughts. I know particularly with respect to what Congressman Meeks was saying about trade adjustment assistance, I know you've been thinking about other approaches as well, Congressman.
Yeah, and we are looking. I mean, clearly, you know, trade is complex, and it's emotional, and it's difficult. And as the world grows smaller and flatter, in a sense, it gets more difficult to do this. And I think the Doha round is a reflection not only of setting pretty high goals, but the fact of the matter is we have more countries involved in WTO. They are far more sophisticated about trade. They have greater data about the impact that has in their countries. And so it makes it harder to reach an agreement, a consensual agreement at such a huge level. But I think we absolutely have to, and we're sort of at a critical time, I think, in trade for this country, and not just from an economic standpoint, but from, you know, the fact that we're here today talking about international strategy and trade being a part of our security agenda, which it is, in around the world, I think is fairly encouraging, because mm-hmm. people have always read a lot into trade, but I don't think on the negative side, I don't think they've read into it quite the positive side it can have for our interest. And as complex as trade is, I always do like to start the discussion with what I think is the principle behind why we trade. And to me, it is it's a principle of freedom. You know, if you or I build a better mousetrap, we should be free to sell it anywhere in the world without government interference. And if someone else builds a better mousetrap, you and I should be free to buy it, again, without government interference, whether it's for our family or for a business. And I think that principle of freedom is very important for us. Yet today, you know, we're looking at a world that is very aggressively creating agreements, regardless of the United States, the tilt much the world against us when our companies try to compete. I think we've over-exaggerated, in some sense, trade's impact, yet we've not recognized its ability to really to strategically help us make regions more secure, to help export democracy and rule of law. And today, you know, as most things in life, having a balanced approach on trade that both recognizes the benefits from it and very aggressively recognizes the downside of it is very important to us. And I think, too, recognizing that while we are hopeful for something to occur in Doha, that our trade policy shouldn't be one-legged, where we have a completely depend upon a successful Doha route. We ought to have a broader stance that also keeps us engaged in the bilaterals, because they are working for us. I mean, even though our bilaterals are only about 7%, I think of the world market, they're almost half of everything we're selling abroad. And you probably all noticed in this room, have noticed the past few months, even in our trade deficit, you've seen the lines cross where the rate of growth of what we're selling out of America is exceeding the rate of growth of what we're buying into America. That's a trend we ought to be, as a Congress, ought to be continuing to push. But boy, there's just a lot of elements going on right now that Grant, I'm sure, wants to talk about that affect whether we can keep that trend going or not.
Well, both of what you're talking about offers a rich sort of menu of things we could. I want to start actually from a perspective that I know you both share, where you've both been very strong supporters of what I think of as the root of economic development, small and minority businesses in our country. And yet that's not a voice that has been well heard or even, frankly, looked after as a part of our trade policy. There hasn't really been that effort in one sense to draw that constituency further into the discussion. And I'd be interested in how your perspective about economic development, particularly small and minority businesses, affects the way you view trade and how you think about the two fitting together. Because I wonder if there isn't a more powerful argument to be made about what we do here to liberate people and empower people to engage in global commerce rather than thinking about throwing up barriers.
Well, you know, that's my vein of existence, to be quite honest with you. I was one of 15 Democrats to vote for CAFTA, you know, there was a whole lot of individuals who wanted to come after me.
Yeah.
But the reason why they couldn't, because I already had built in somewhat of a cushion, because I was focused on first getting businesses and getting minority and small businesses within my district focused on the advantages and how they can make money in training and setting up programs in regards with the Commerce Department on helping assist them with trading with other countries. Mm-hmm. So therefore, they were creating jobs, and they understood to go out on trade missions that created an opportunity for them. From my way of thinking, you know, this is globalization and the opportunity to get into the other markets is the 21st century of the version of the California Gold Rush, you know, where people were all trying to go west. Well, now we've got this globe that's much smaller now, and people can go out there, and there's places where you can go, expand your businesses, make money, and create jobs at home. And that becomes key. When I look at, for example, UPS, you know, which JFK Airport's in the middle of my district, UPS is a large business, but I just use this as an example of job creation of something that I utilize all the time in the district, is for every 40 packages that they send abroad, that creates one job at JFK Airport.
Yeah.
And then that one job is someone that's there, and I can relate that to folks who says that trade means your job, and therefore, despite all of the pressures that I would get from someone else, it hits home. And when you talk to the small businesses, you know, that then creates a real economic development tool and a complete independency. The community then can stand on its own and not be completely dependent upon government to do anything and everything for it. It makes it freer, using Kevin's word, freer for the people to move in areas where they had not done before, and makes them understand better, because it affects their lives directly, the benefits of trade. And I think that makes a tremendous difference when you try to work it that way on the ground level, and you ask the assistance of those who are making the benefit to then to be the mouthpieces on the benefits of trade, right, as opposed to it just being me.
Right.
And they go out there with their new employees, and they push out, and they then talk, and I don't have to say anything.
Right.
And that then brings new partners into this thing.
It's a wonderful story about how you mobilize that support, but that was really your initiative as much as anything else. And what I've been surprised by in some respects, Kevin, is the inability to make the supply chain vibrate. You know, most small businesses don't export directly to Japan. They might export to Toyota, or they might export to General Electric, in effect, and they take them global. And yet, you don't really have the sense that you're reaching down in that supply chain and saying, we're all in this together. I remember this wonderful graphic Boeing had at one point that had its 747 with the names of every one of its American suppliers listed on that plane in very fine print, because there was a huge thousands, literally, of suppliers, down to the folks who were providing the hot dog stand across the street from the factory in Renton. And it was the sort of thing where you really felt those voices aren't heard as a part of the process. I'm wondering, in Texas, what do you do in that context to try and mobilize those same sorts of voices?
You know, when before I came to Congress, I was a Chamber of Commerce manager. So ran a small business myself, worked with small businesses. And so when I came to Washington, you're always looking, where can we create, how can we create more jobs? And it became clear, at least at the national level, the way we do that is we make sure that we can sell our goods and services around the world. But small businesses are smart, and because they're meeting a payroll, you know, they're pretty aggressive about seeking out new customers and finding them. I think our small business owners and our business leaders understand the supply chain. I don't think the workers who are employed there do. And I think that's been one of the problems in trade, why I'm always hopeful that Greg Meeks is not a endangered species by taking this role, because if you look at who our customers are, the business growth we're seeing, a lot of our workers, I think, are not aware of what an important role free trade plays, or else they would be up here clamoring for us to keep opening those markets. And I really lay that blame on our business community for not talking to the folks who are around the water cooler, whose jobs are dependent upon this. And I just did, I'll conclude with this, I just did a tour of our manufacturing facilities in East Texas, which is not really known for manufacturing, but we figured out there's about 300 companies that employ about 18,000 folks, everything from steel mills to paper plants to oil bits to everything. Just toured them, you know, plywood, plywood racks, all these different things. We discovered in East Texas that all those companies were exporting between one-third and one-half of all that they were making outside. And when I would tell my local reporters, you know, in Chamber of Commerce about that, they were sort of in disbelief. And I think our export world, in effect, is sort of semi-invisible, you know what I mean, in the United States. We just don't have enough discussion. And it makes it politically tougher for people in both parties, but especially in Greg's, to step up and say, no, we need to do this. So,
let me shift really directly onto the politics of trade. I know testifying in front of Ways and Means this year, I wasn't surprised about the obvious shift in control of Congress and what that might imply for the trade agenda going forward. What I was really surprised by was looking at the shift within each caucus. It felt like, at least in the questions and certainly in terms of the members, that there was a drift toward a more populist version of politics, really tapping what seemed to be anxiety about globalization. The first thing I wanted to know from your guys' perspective, is that an accurate perception? And if so, what does that portend in terms of what we're going to do going down the road in trade policy? Because what that suggests to me in some respects is you do have to find a much stronger bipartisan consensus, and that it may be that foreign policy arguments become relatively more important in building that consensus as opposed to the classic trade arguments and the benefits of trade that we've argued about before. Maybe you could start us off.
Well, I think if you polled members of the House and just privately asked them, I would say the number who would like to have a trade vote each year would fit in a telephone booth. I mean, politically, it's just not very popular. I was real encouraged, still am, about the agreement that was reached between Chairman Rangel, Jim McCrary, Senator Baucus, USTR, because I thought what it represented, whether you agreed completely with it all or not, what it represented was the ability of people with very different views on trade to sit down and work out accommodations that actually try to spread those benefits better and try to export more of our values, and they did it quietly and thoughtfully and came up, I thought, with just a real important framework. What worries me now is that I worry that the populist feel against trade may derail that breakthrough before it really gets going. I worry about, with Peru especially, as sort of the lead car in this four-car train of pending bilaterals, I worry that we are almost recreating a America's big stick diplomacy, where we basically require countries to do unimaginable things before we even consider those agreements. It seems terribly unfair. I think Peru, we need to have a hearing this month on it. There's no reason I'd go forward with that agreement. To Panama, with both the expansion of the canal and their services sector, much like economy, much like America, very important we do that. Greg Meeks spoke the other day about Colombia. I'll let him do that because he was so articulate about, you know, the global, the strategic need for Colombia and Korea, huge market. The type of trade agreements we ought to be pursuing every moment we get a chance to, you know, and all that. And what I worry about is that some want to slow that four-car train down so that maybe the last two cars never make it to the station. And that, in a political environment we have today, that worries me.
Mm-hmm. What I hear you saying, though, is that that probably, with most members of Congress, whether Republican or Democrat, that wouldn't be a problem in the sense that you'd rather not face that vote, particularly going into an 08 election, I guess would be the best way to put it.
You know, I've been in Congress 11 years, and I've had international trade as a part of probably every speech I've given, mm-hmm. you know, for a decade. And still in our district, when we consider trade agreements, the letters and phone calls are easily 50-1 against it. So most members, you know, given a choice, would prefer not to have to engage that thing, even though they know we need to do it.
Yeah, and as a result of that, you have a situation people are saying, don't confuse me with the facts. Mm-hmm. You know, so don't even, you can't get open minds to listen to the facts and the benefits of what trade is really about, because it's just such opposition, you know, from the outside. And you have, you know, the Lou Dobbses of the world that's on all the time, whether it's on your radio or on your television, yeah. indoctrinating people with, you know, with certain dogma. And therefore, they believe, you know, perception then to them becomes the reality.
Right.
And you have individuals who have now, I know on my side of the aisle, who claim that they were elected using no trade agreements. So therefore, they cannot now go back and show any semblance of supporting any kind of trade agreement, irrespective of what the facts may be. And that gives me some grave concerns. However, you know, there seems to be somewhat of a contradiction when you really bring it to the people, because to my knowledge, I know none of the CAFTA 15 lost their seats because of the vote on CAFTA, everyone. Yeah. I don't know of anyone that really has lost their seat simply because of a trade vote. Mm-hmm. I really don't. I've tried to, somebody could show me one maybe I've missed. I've had my staff and I look to try to figure out where a member voted for trade, and because of that single vote, they lost his or her election. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that that's a component, but when they look at it, they should be able to move forward, but that's not happening.
Yeah.
I think that what's happening is that people continue to move the goalposts. Mm. And I was with Kevin. I mean, I thought that finally there was a breakthrough,
right,
so that we could really have a bipartisan, because trade should not be one of those partisan issues. It's too important for this country for too many reasons. Mm-hmm. It should not be a partisan issue. That should be one of those bipartisan issues that we should be able to agree upon to work together for the benefit of our country. And that's not taking place. People are moving the goalposts. I worry about Peru. I thought Peru and Panama would at least, and I agree with you, that I thought that the deck was being stacked so that Peru and Panama would get through, the other two wouldn't. But now I'm seeing they're trying to change the goalposts on Peru, which is a problem, which concerns me. I start scratching my head. What's going on here? Mm-hmm. I thought we, you know, had something, you know, that was a done deal here. Because I know beforehand what we were all talking about, at least a lot of the Democrats who had not been able to vote for trade before, said they needed labor standards in the agreement. That's done. Mm-hmm. They said they needed environmental standards in the agreement, not side agreements. Right. That's done. Mm-hmm. They said they wanted access to generic medicines. That's done. And so the things that we were talking about before that seemed to prevent a partisan fight should have been eliminated as far as I was concerned. Mm-hmm. And the talking between McCreary and Charlie Rangel, which I thought also was part of the problem before, because Charlie and Mr. Thomas didn't speak at all, or didn't speak, you know, in any kind of cohesive manner.
They didn't speak to each other. They didn't talk to each other. Sure.
They were speaking.
They were speaking. But that changed, and to a degree, I do feel some frustration, not only myself, but even from some of the leaders of that agreement. Because I think part of it was that they thought that they could move forward and people will immediately follow. But you had an upsurge of new members that said, how dare you make that agreement? Mm,
got it.
And so you have that kind of problem that is percolating now in as far as politics is concerned. Mm-hmm. And what we've got to figure out is how do we resolve it? Now, again, my hope is that we will ultimately push through mm-hmm. Panama and Peru, or Peru and Panama. But I do have to put the plug in for Colombia, because to me, Colombia is absolutely important to be lumped in with all three of those. Mm. How do we not do a Colombia? When we go, if we do a Peru, which needs it, should have it, we do a Panama, we've done a NAFTA, we've done a CAFTA, we've got a Chile. Now, what are we doing to say, or what are we saying as a national interest to Colombia, who is our partner in helping us fighting drugs and doing everything that they can? And if you look at the difference between Colombia in the last 7 years with President Uribe there, the gains that they've made, how can we turn our backs on them? And then when you look at the opportunities are there. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I was reading a magazine on the way back from Colombia not too long ago. And they were talking about the Colombian market, how it was soaring despite, you know, all of the so-called black clouds around it. Mm-hmm. Its GDP is going up, and you know, there's a lot of companies that are starting to hedge funds and private equity is looking to invest money there. You know, it to me would be in our best interest to make sure that Peru happens, Panama happens, Colombia happens, and Korea happens.
You know, you said something which I want to drill down on a little bit, Representative Minks, because it goes to the heart of, you guys are master politicians. I think about this in the context of John Tester, senator from Montana, very vigorous opponent of trade, got up, said things about NAFTA which are just frankly untrue, but that was his campaign rhetoric. Now, he represents the state of Montana where a third of those acres go to export, and that the cattlemen have to export, not so much because it's a huge market, but because every time they export, it raises the price of everything they sell. And so now he's got this huge constituent interest. He has to find a way to make that turn politically. And I think it's in our interest to help him make that turn. How do we create the political space, just using John Tester as the model, so that he can vote in favor of those constituents? How do we find either what we're doing inside of trade agreements or in policies around trade agreements, something that would take us further down that road? Hard question.
Yeah, you know, I think it is having the courage to lead on trade is critical. But also, I think the more we are vigorously enforcing trade agreements, mm-hmm. and at the WTO level, mm-hmm. because it is the perceived unfairness of trade that also drives a number of John Tester's mm-hmm. constituents. And I think when we really do pick out, you know, export subsidies or yep. import substitutions or things that really are clearly unfair and go after them, I think it helps a Senator Tester go home and say, you know, we're not just reaching contracts with these countries. We're actually holding them accountable, you know, to implement and perform on that contract. Now, and I think it's helped.
Yeah, good point.
Yeah, I like what you're saying, Congressman Brady, in part because I know in my own experience in negotiating agreements that when we put down the template of a free trade agreement, we usually are talking about the liberalization of the border measures. We don't actually spend a lot of time talking about the policies inside the border that can still distort trade. Mm-hmm. So, for example, we're having a great debate about China and its yeah. currency. A far more serious issue, I know from the Financial Services Committee perspective, is what is wrong with the capital market in China
Absolutely.
That produces a series of underlying very powerful subsidies to capital-intensive reed manufacturing industries in China. And at the root cause of that problem lies inside China. The best thing you could do is blow that open for financial services and have a capital market that works. Yeah. But when we sit down to bargain, we don't actually think about that. We sort of think about what's at the border rather than those interior measures. And I wonder, if particularly on the services side, whether that isn't more than half the game is shifting how we bargain, Congressman Meeks. It's sort of everything about services, whether it's the investment barriers that prevent you from going in, whether it's the regulations that favor the domestic industry, or in China's case, the idea that you know, I hate to say it, it's a little bit like what the old emperors used to do for Marco Polo. Yes, you can have the silk trade in Shanghai, but nowhere else. And that's sort of what we've done with our financial services companies as well. You can operate, sell life insurance, not health insurance, only in Guangdong. And that's the WTO arrangement at this point, rather than something that would drive change throughout the financial services market. But would that help, in one sense, to be able to respond to a John Tester's concerns or other concerns that you see among members?
I know it would help tremendously, and I think that's why Kevin and I are co-chairs on the Services Caucus, because that's mm-hmm. part of the reason for the existence of the Services Caucus, so that the services, you know, even with our trade rep, mm-hmm. become an integral part of their conversation
right.
when they're negotiating these agreements, and when you have those barriers set up, fight through them
yeah.
for the services.
Yeah.
And it seems to me it makes a tremendous advantage in that regard, because when you look at the jobs that the services are creating and the fact that we've had a positive trade balance mm-hmm. in the services industry, mm-hmm. if we fought for that and fight, you know, against those barriers that may put up in China or in India and some other places where we could really grow and prosper, it would make a difference, and people will also feel the difference at home and have the confidence that when you make an agreement that we are going to fight to make sure that our folks. I think Kevin's point is absolutely right on target.
One of the things Greg and I tried to make at the launching of the Services Caucus was not just the fact that, you know, services are a huge part of our economy. These are not McJobs. These are good-paying jobs, average about $51,000 each for these services jobs. America's very good at it. We have a big trade surplus. We are extremely, we ought to be insisting on this. But one of the points Greg and I tried to make was, look, this is not an either-or situation. Either services or agriculture.
Right.
Services or manufacturing. Truth of the matter is, in the era of America's prosperity throughout the decades is, manufacturing, the rise of manufacturing made agriculture more productive. You know, the rise of services and information knowledge has made manufacturing more productive
yeah.
and more competitive around the world.
Absolutely.
So this really is complementary to all. We're trying to lift all those sectors up.
That's a great way to look at it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's open it up for questions. I know I've sort of stayed away from the what's going to happen on Columbia, what's going to happen on Fast Track, but I'm guessing we're going to get that. But anyway, please. Yeah.
Yes.
If we could use the microphone, that'd be great.
Thank you. Paul Chamberlain.
Could you also tell us your affiliation?
Paul Chamberlain, can you hear me?
Yes,
I'm a consultant and adjunct fellow here at the center. My enduring interests have to do with the Korean FTA, but my question pertains to illegal immigration and the impact of these trade agreements on that subject. It's an important subject for Americans. To what extent would passing these agreements with the Latin American countries affect the illegal immigration situation, and is there a political argument there to support these trade agreements?
Well, I say that all the time, that especially on our hemisphere, our western hemisphere, our western hemisphere, that if why do people come illegally or whatever way to the United States? They want hope and opportunity to get a job so they can support their families, primarily because they can't do it at home. If, in fact, we created an atmosphere where they could get jobs that paid so that they could take care of their families and they could have the same kind of prosperous outlook that Americans have, there would be no desire for them to come illegally to the United States of America. They could do it right there. And all it takes is to go to visit and talk to individuals and ask them, why are you coming to America? Well, they want what America's promise is because they don't have. But if they had America's promise, they'd stay at home. You know why you know that, too, is because when you talk to them, even after they're here, they always talk about how good things are at home, or they would like to go back home, or their families are back home. So there's, to me, there's absolutely an argument that I say all the time that if you create hope and opportunity for people in other places, especially in our neighbors, then, in fact, you don't have the immigration problem because that's the reason why the individuals are coming here.
I agree, and I think, I think this is one of those arguments that have been lost in immigration as we go about the debate. But also two things. One is that, you know, I think perhaps either NAFTA was a bit oversold on the impact it would have on stemming illegal immigration, or people don't recognize what happened internally that helped drive it since NAFTA was in place. I think that undermines our argument a bit. But I'm with Greg. I was in El Salvador and working on CAFTA, and they showed me this newspaper advertisement in Spanish, obviously. But it basically said that the ad said, this Mother's Day, call your mother in the United States for this discount. On Mother's Day, call your mom in America for this amount. And it just struck me that we have two little boys, 5 and 8 year old. I can barely drag my wife away from them for a weekend. The thought that a mom who loves her children dearly would travel 1,000 miles, go into the shadows, work like a dog just to send money home for a family. You can't convince me if there wasn't the opportunity, a chance for a decent job at home, she wouldn't be there, wouldn't be back there in a second. And I think in all these trade agreements, I really think whether we are creating opportunities in the home country, in my view. Maybe not enough, maybe not soon enough, maybe our economy is just such a magnet that we just need to recognize that. But I'm with Greg. I think it has to help in this whole issue.
Other questions? Yeah, please, Jim.
Hi, thank you. Jim Berger from Washington Trade Daily. Since the presidential campaign seems to be starting early and the House is always in a campaign mode, is it unfair to say that it would be to the political benefit of Republicans to see all the trade agreements go down this year or next, and then blame it on Democrats?
No.
Let's stop there.
No campaign is worth how much damage I think that would create for our country in a number of ways, in leadership and whoever. One that presidency would be spending far too much time trying to undo the damage than moving forward. And for me, in my party, I'm not voting for any candidate for president who doesn't have the intellect and the courage to lead on free trade. I mean, in fact, I have to credit President Clinton who made trade, you know, a key part, who understood that we have to speak with one voice, even with internal differences, working those out. And I just hope the nominees for both parties will be able to step up and lead the same way.
Please, Tom.
Thank you very much. I'm Tom Hubbard at Kissinger McCarty Associates, and in the interest of full disclosure, I'm a former ambassador to Korea. Since this is a dialogue, I hope I can make a comment rather than simply ask.
We know where he's coming from.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
<okay. laughs> But I didn't want to waste this opportunity to give my views on this agreement.
Grab the mic.
Key members of Congress. Congressman Brady, you mentioned that it's huge. It is huge. It's $78 billion in trade, likely to add another $20 billion. Korea is our seventh largest trading partner, 10th largest economy in the world. It's a good agreement, probably the best we have done. It's very good for services. And I think most importantly on the economic side, this is an opportunity to further crack open an economy that has been one of the most difficult to crack for American goods and services throughout time. The Koreans want to open their economy. This is a chance to further that process. Is strategically important in different ways, perhaps, than the Colombian agreement, and I strongly support that, too. But it's a key ally and a key part of the world. This trade agreement will help cement our ties in Asia, will help counter what we've seen over time of increasing drift in some parts away from the United States and more in direction of China. We ought to do this because of our position in Asia. It's also a wonderful...
I'm going to exercise the prerogative of an old Senate hack who's familiar with filibusters. But these guys are from the House. We're governed by the rules in this conversation, so I think we're done.
One final word. It's a good template. The Japanese are already, I think, positively
Absolutely.
Expressing concern about this. I think it will help us further our process in Asia.
In Asia generally.
Yes,
yeah,
ma'am.
Great. Please.
Hi, Bill Irwin with Chevron. Looking at the Western Hemisphere, there's been a lot of political flux in the hemisphere over the past several years. A lot of pendulum swinging in elections. A lot of conversations amongst themselves. New alliances forming. New trade groups within the hemisphere, within South America, is kind of redefining themselves with three alliances. Yet at the same time, there's countries that are involved in these free trade negotiations with the United States that really want them, that are putting their arm out a little bit and not moving with the momentum that some of their neighbors are moving. They're doing the things that y'all referred to in your opening statements of responding to some of the new requests that are coming out of the 110th Congress to reopen these agreements. They're complying with all that. I see in my BlackBerry as you're talking, the Panamanian legislature just approved the FTA 58-3. They're doing all the things that to say that they want to have these agreements in the midst of all this very difficult flux that's involving a lot of their neighbors. If we can't deliver to them the relationship they want with us, what's going to happen over time with in that political environment that's evolving in South America right now?
Good question. You've got that. I mean, given the distribution of income in Latin America, politics are always going to be center-left. But you also have some very serious issues in terms of Chavez, in terms of the change in Ecuador, certainly the issues in Bolivia. It represents a dynamic, whereas you have other slightly left-to-center governments who, in fact, are pretty strong advocates of economic liberalization, engagement in the global economy. And the real question is, if we don't embrace that with this opportunity, are we conceding something to the Chavez of the world and end up with a very different dynamic among our neighbors?
Well, you know, here's the way I go on this. I do believe that those that have agreed and those legislatures that you're talking about, we do and need to make sure that we push back and work with them. Because I think you do have a battle of two systems. And I think ultimately, you know, just as we had during the Cold War period when the socialist system in Russia fail, you're going to find the same thing. There's no way that I believe that a number of these other countries, that their systems are going to be able to survive. And the best way for them to learn and realize that, I think, is when we do have these trade agreements. Example is what's going on with Chile right now. And it shows how their economy and people are booming, and folks from the bottom up is benefiting. And I think that's what's key. So that's why I believe in a lot of the trade agreements, we have to have capacity, trade capacity building dollars for those countries so that people in the bottom, the poor, be able to benefit from it also. And that's why with Colombia, I work very closely with the African Colombian community that's in there to make sure that they're a part of it. And in Peru, the African Peruvians and the indigenous individuals, that they can benefit, because that's really where the battle lies. the battle lies on the bottom. You know, there was a poll done, and a lot of those individuals said, we don't care, in essence, what form of government we have as long as it improves our lives. And I believe that if we do these right, and I think that from talking to the Peruvian government, from talking to the Panamanian government, from talking to the Colombian government, and seeing the example of the Chilean government, that we can do these things right. That's why it's a crucial time, in my estimation, that we move forward with these kinds of agreements and understand, you know, and I think Kevin mentioned this earlier, the connection therein with our own security at home, you know, with reference to the day and age that we now live in, dealing with terrorists and terrorism, et cetera. You know, you look at what took place at John F. Kennedy Airport not too long ago with individuals coming through Trinidad. And if it wasn't working with those governments there, you know, we could have had a security breach here. So the same is with a number of them that particularly want to deal with us. And we've got to figure out a better way to do that. And I think that has to be part of the arguments that we make when we are fighting for these free trade agreements.
You know, both the question and your response raises something that kind of brings us full circle, which is we have not done a very effective job of paralleling what we do in terms of our development policy, our economic development policy, whether it's here at home or whether it's internationally, with what we do on trade. And you're making the point about trade capacity building. One of the interesting things about NAFTA is its reach into northern Mexico is very strong. Its reach in southern Mexico is very light. And much of that has to do with logistical issues in southern Mexico as much as it has
to
do
with. You're right.
And the reality is the price transmission benefits of trade don't benefit the poor in southern Mexico. They have not seen the benefit of NAFTA in that sense. But part of that, I wonder if it isn't because we take these sort of dichotomous views of what economic development assistance is and what trade is, rather than saying we both ought to have them at the table, in some respects, particularly in Latin America, because of the income disparities, and trying to develop a more coherent policy, in some respects, about our approach on trade at the end of the day.
But Chavez is Chavez is popular, and I go to Venezuela just as much as I go anyplace else, to be quite honest with you. Chavez is popular for one reason. For the first time, he's giving at least lip service to those who don't have. And he's made a difference in some of those communities in the sense that I've gone to some where there's schools that they have for the first time. Mm-hmm. There are, you know, he's feeding some folks for the first time that had not had government pay any attention to them previously. Yeah. So they're not looking at the, you know, the big picture of what the system does. They're looking at, well, for the first time, we've got somebody that's caring about us, and so therefore we love him.
I agree with you completely. It's sort of like, you know, having spent a lot of my professional life in Latin America, it's the failure of a political elite in Venezuela, and it's a rejection of that political elite. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, it's taken a turn that isn't pro-democratic.
That's correct.
At this circumstance, but the reasons for it are exactly what you stated. Absolutely. Yeah. Kevin, I think we're going to have your comment, maybe one more question, then I think in interest of your time, we're gonna scoot. I don't know if you want to comment on this one, Kevin.
No, I think we're in perfect court. I think history will treat us poorly if we don't keep engaged.
The last one right here in the front row, if we could.
My name is Abdi Chama. I'm the ambassador at large for Somalia, and I used to be here the last acting ambassador of Somalia in the 90s, 80s. I just want to comment what Congressman Brady said about freedom. I think he's right, because when you empower, particularly the small business, people create jobs. They employ not only the immediate family, but they employ others. I was recently in East Africa, Kenya, I went to Somalia too, and I found out that they enlarged the East African community by including not only the traditional three countries, Uganda, Tanzania, Kenya, including Burundi, Rwanda, and also the East and Central, Southern Africa, economic community, you know, in terms of trade. The human understanding that America really has, why everyone wants to come here, is that the fact, the freedom. You see, everyone, we have been raised, you know, from the colonization and after the post-colonization by leaders who do not want, there's only one president, one newspaper, and one radio. So they come here not only for bettering their lives, but also for the freedom that exists here. freedom of worship, freedom of assembly, freedom of speech. Thank you.
I think that's a wonderful place to end, because what I take from that is that a monopoly ain't any good, whether it's economic or political, number one. And the power of trade is that leveling force. It is that liberation in one sense, because even the guy on top, whether it's Microsoft or whether it's Exxon, can't stay there for long without somebody having the opportunity to compete and start to erode that. So they got to stay nimble and be responsive to the folks at the bottom, too. And I think that's ultimately where we need to go. I want to thank you both for launching our dialogue series. This really has been tremendous. A lot of insight, particularly about, I think, where we need to go to find new voices to bring into the trade conversation. It's also a lesson I want to just say for my friends in business about what we have to tap to bring into the conversation, because, you know, you guys are the legs in some respect. It's those guys around the water fountain, as Kevin was saying, that we got to draw on to the positive side of the conversation and say there is a broader world out there we can grab. But they have to be motivated to see their future in that world. And that's ultimately where the cause ends. Thank you very, very much. Appreciate it.